From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The state of American politics has devolved to such an extent under President Donald Trump that there seems to be no end to the depravity and antagonism, the deception and the ugliness that we as a society appear to be willing to tolerate. Perhaps we're simply too fatigued to keep up with the barrage of propaganda, name-calling, and intransigence from various political factions. Now, a new book hopes to remind us that it is indeed possible to have civil discourse, engage in actual political and philosophical debate, and still be part of the same community. Keith M. Parsons is a professor of philosophy at the University of Houston, Clear Lake. His earlier books include It Started with Copernicus, Rational Episodes, and God and the Burden of Proof. His new book, co-authored with Paris M. Donahue, is called Polarized: The Collapse of Truth, Civility, and Community in Divided Times, and How We Can Find Common Ground. Welcome to the program, Keith.
Thank you very much, Sonali.
So can you begin by telling us about your friendship with your co-author, Paris Donahue, and what your differences with him are and how it formed the basis for the story you tell in the book?
Well, when I say that we're old friends, that's quite literally true. We've known each other for about 60 years, going literally back to first grade. So we became very good friends, best friends at the time. And life, of course, took us in different directions. He eventually entered the ministry as in the United Church of Christ after various spiritual and ideological peregrinations. We wound up in different places. I became an atheist, yet we stayed in touch, and we get together every Christmas. And when we go back to our home state of Georgia and get together for laughs and a dinner, and we decided then to, in 2016, we were both so chagrined following the election of Donald Trump with what was going on in the country, we decided that we needed to write a book together.
So what are your differences with your co-author, and how do they illustrate that it is indeed possible to be on different sides of a spectrum, of an ideological spectrum, and still talk to one another?
Well, again, our worldviews are basically different. He is a Christian. He believes in revelation. He accepts that Christ is his savior. The New Testament for him is the word of God. He's certainly not a fundamentalist in any sense whatsoever, but he is a committed Christian. I, on the other hand, am an atheist. I'm a naturalist. I accept that the physical world is all that there is. And so our fundamental views about the bases of ethics and everything else are very different. Yet we found a tremendous confluence in our ideas. I guess it was in a similar emotional response that got us to talk. And then we found out that our ideas also came together remarkably consistently, despite the differences in our basic worldviews.
And is that because there are some basic assumptions about humanity and truth that you can agree on?
I think it's because certain things matter to both of us, matter very fundamentally, and that's why we decided to write about it. We asked the question, what was it in the campaign and election of Donald Trump that disturbed us the most? And we thought that, well, it's that certain values, certain core civic virtues have been pervasively and radically undermined. This didn't start with Donald Trump, but he in many ways is the paradigm. He epitomizes it. And we decided that truthfulness, the basic willingness to tell the truth to each other, fundamental civility, the willingness to be decent to one another, the willingness to disagree with each other without expressions of contempt and disdain, and finally, community and diversity, the fundamental ideal e pluribus unum that we think that America is or should be based upon. And we found that those values seemed to be completely undermined. And for each of us, this was something that was just fundamentally, egregiously wrong and had to be addressed.
So there's Trump and his constant contradictions of himself, of fact, and his name calling. But then there's this entire community of support behind him, albeit a minority and possibly a shrinking minority, still a significant number of Americans who, in spite of knowing that he lies and lies often and lies openly, continue to back him. What does that say about that group of Americans, about that, about the fact that there is this significant percentage of Americans that is willing to set aside the ideas of truth being a good thing?
That's the key question. That's the core question. And I think that something terrible has happened. I think that, well, of course, anti-intellectualism has always been a part of the American tradition, we might say, as Richard Hofstadter said in his classic book with the that title, Anti-Intellectualism in American History, published over 50 years ago. But I think things have gotten much, much worse. Journalist Charles P. Pierce wrote a book called, with the entertaining title, Idiot America, which is both hilarious and horrifying. And in that book, he basically says that we have reached the point that for a substantial number of people, the operational definition of truth is what my gut tells me. And any sort of criteria of objectivity, any information from experts and science, it's not only ignored, it's positively repudiated. So many of the people on the what passes for conservative side today, so many people on the right, they denigrate and dismiss scientific information and expertise, so that the very idea of truth as being something which we can know, which we can grasp, which is something apart from us and above us, that's decayed, that's deteriorated, and truth becomes just what my gut tells me. And as Pierce says, my gut is my inner idiot. You know, so
a Christian like your co-author also take this rational, reality-based approach to the world if their worldview is also in part based on a myth for which there is no actual proof and in which they simply have a deep faith?
I think actually one of the things that I talk about and that we both actually talk about in the introductions, you know, some people have said that we devoted a little bit too much time introducing ourselves, and I hope we won't be seen as egocentric. But the reason we did is basically to outline our positions and how we can discover common ground. I think that I have come to see faith not so much as just a blind leap in the dark, as sort of a choice that we make on the basis of the totality of our life experiences. For me, the totality of my experience basically says it's physics all the way down, that ultimately physics can explain everything from a supernova to a passing thought. For Paris, on the other hand, his fundamental experience, his global, we might say, holistic experience in life has been different. And so each of us must make a choice in that regard. We must make a commitment to what seems real to us. It is a deep choice. It's a rational choice, but in some ways it is a choice in the sense of it being a commitment. One of the leading philosophers of religion, John Hick, says the world is ambiguous. To some people, like me, it seems like it's physics all the way down. To others, they feel themselves living in the presence of God. Is it either being irrational? Hick doesn't think so, and he's persuaded me.
So we have an evangelical community in the United States that supports Donald Trump, even though they know he's not a strong believer by any sense of that word. He is not someone known to be devout, although he's surrounded by, you know, people like Mike Pence and his former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who fall more in that vein. But the evangelical community has embraced Trump because they see him, or some parts of it at least, of that community, see him as being a means to an end that they deeply desire, such as, for example, an end to abortion rights and other religious rights for their Christian community. Do you see that as a subversion of their values, of their Christian values?
Well, it certainly appears to be. I know when the famous Access Hollywood video came out with Donald Trump bragging about, in vulgar terms, about abusing women, I thought, well, that's it. How can the evangelical community continue to support him? Yet, if anything, their support only strengthened at that point. And I know many intelligent and decent people who are evangelical Christians who support Donald Trump and seem to be continue. And it is a deep mystery to me. It is a deep mystery how they possibly can accept someone who is, clearly a serial adulterer on top of everything else with an X-rated mind. How can they accept someone like that as their leader? Of course, you've got the Supreme Court, and of course they want, conservatives on the Supreme Court, but surely it's something deeper than that. Surely it's something deeper than that. It's something about, Donald Trump that resonates with very conservative people. I don't know what it is. I wish I did know.
You have a chapter in your book that I think is really critical, and it's part of your subtitle as well, which is this idea of civility. Now, on the one hand, civil discourse, particularly between politicians, is essential just to have government actually working. On the other hand, the lack of civility can sometimes be an effective tool by grassroots groups trying to expose the powerful and expose elites. So how do we understand civility and its proper use, if you will, in a democracy?
There is definitely a tension there. I mean, sometimes it seems as though a civility does conflict with truth, that sometimes in expressing the truth about someone, we have to say some very rough things about them, perhaps even subject them to satire and ridicule. And of course, ridicule is not a friendly thing, okay? I think about Tina Fey and, Sarah Palin. That in 2008, when Sarah Palin was the vice presidential choice, and you had, the wickedly spot-on sort of satire of her on Saturday Night Live, I think that was entirely appropriate. I think that sometimes when there is a clear and present danger to our basic values in society, when someone represents such a danger, then we may be justified in satirizing or even ridiculing them, descending to that level of lack of civility. But as I say in the book, even then there should be limits of taste. Even then we don't do skits in which we say display their apparently severed heads, as one so-called comedian did. We don't ridicule
or make fun of their children. I feel like that should be off limits.
or make fun of people who are powerless. You always make fun of the powerful, and you don't make fun of them for things they cannot help. You make fun of them for the precisely nasty, vicious, cruel things that they do. And so that's one of the things we must consider. And so I think that there are rules of civility even when we satirize.
Right. I mean, there were in the past several months, there have been some groups of activists that have quite effectively dogged the Republicans in restaurants and elevators, taken them to task, videotaped their interactions in questioning them and posted them. And the Republicans and, people upset about these interactions and these confrontations have denounced them as uncivil, even as they back a president like Trump. And it seems as though those are two different things that they're talking about, because the power dynamic is critical when the powerless are trying to confront the powerful. A lack of civility can be a useful tool, but when the powerful uses a lack of civility as a form of abuse, then it's just simply that, right? Just abuse, such as the way in which Trump has treated, say, Maxine Waters and many other people.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, I think the archetypical instance was during his campaign when a disabled reporter had the sheer temerity to criticize him, and Donald Trump actually mocked and ridiculed the disability of that reporter. I mean, it was very clear what kind of a man we were dealing with at that point. I mean, when they say that Caesar Augustus would make fun of a hunchback, well, Donald Trump will only do it if the hunchback criticizes him. So I guess, he's more civil than Caesar Augustus. But anyway, so, when the powerful ridicule people on the basis of their disabilities or their ethnicities or their gender, then I think that is rightly condemned. But when those of us without much power can at times use ridicule, against the powerful, then I think it may indeed be justified. But the basis of civility, as I understand it, is that when you are talking with someone, when someone approaches you and wants to honestly talk, your default assumption is that this is a rational human being with whom I can have a reasonable conversation and do not just dismiss them as evil idiots. I think the sort of default assumption these days is that if anyone disagrees with you, he or she must be an idiot or evil. And I think that's the default assumption that we criticize. Your default assumption, on the contrary, should be this is a human being trying to find his or her way through this veil of tears, the same as me. And our default assumption should be that we attempt to talk. If you can't talk, if they won't let you talk with them, if they return your rationality with contempt and abuse, no need to play that game. Just seek rational discourse elsewhere.
Hmm. Right. I want to actually just quote from your book where you say it so eloquently. Civility is most crucially important because treating people civilly reminds us that they are people. I thought
exactly.
that was quite eloquent. So we unfortunately live in a country where the dehumanization of whole groups has become the basis from which conversations start. And that seems to be the first step towards stripping people of their rights, whether it's women and their right to reproductive autonomy, whether it's Muslims and their right to be in this country, or immigrants and their right to apply for asylum. That lack of civility and the dehumanization that ensues is a first step. How do we restore it? So that last part of the subtitle of your book, how can we find common ground? If we simply say, all right, we're going to find a civil discourse elsewhere, we have written off Trump and all of the people that back him. And I include in that group people like, you know, Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell.
You have to go the extra mile, I think. You know, you have to attempt, you know, to engage in rational discourse insofar as possible with anyone who will talk to you. If anyone will talk to you, then you make every effort to do so. I think that at rock bottom, we have to realize that as human beings, qua human beings, we share certain basic necessities. We share certain basic interests. We are rational creatures. At least we have the potentiality to be rational. We are social creatures. We need each other. And we have to emphasize that those fundamental shared human needs are what constitute our values at rock bottom. And we have to recognize that our fundamental interests cannot be completely incommensurable. They cannot be utterly divergent. At the most fundamental human level, we share basic needs and therefore values. And it is trying to get back in touch with those, I think, that is so essential and so important. I think one way thing to do is to recognize that there are many tasks that we can unite to address. Steven Pinker, in his wonderful book, Enlightenment Now, talks about how we know that certain fundamental human problems have solutions. They can be addressed by means that we know are effective. And it doesn't matter whether you are a liberal or a conservative or whatever, we know that certain fundamental problems can be addressed. And if we recognize that science and scientific thinking, those good old ideals of the Enlightenment still have application and relevance, then we can see common projects. Perhaps we can return back to a level of pragmatism in which we actually start to ask ourselves, what works? What works? Not what does my side, my ideology insist upon, but what actually works? And so if we do that, then as I say in the book, perhaps both liberals and conservatives, people of all political stripes, will realize that instead of having a knee-jerk response in accordance with ideology, perhaps we can do something about developing our inner scientist. You know, we all have an inner idiot, says Charles P. Pierce, but maybe with some work, we can develop an inner scientist in which we can actually ask, what would actually solve these problems?
And it's
What
interesting.
is it?
It's interesting because people, there are unfortunately too many Americans that like to dismiss scientific evidence and will tweet about it on the iPhones that were made possible by scientific discovery and development of scientific technology.
Precisely. I mean, we're living in an age of simply unparalleled scientific and technological development. I mean, with artificial intelligence and the exploration of our solar system and, you know, so many things like that, that, you know, are quite wonderful. And we forget how wonderful they are, you know, and by descending into the political morass. And I think we need to remind people of, you know, our shared interests, the things that we have in common, and the things that we can do in common, the things that we can all participate in. And I think that's my take on it. I think Paris would probably give a different take. Perhaps he would emphasize spiritual qualities more than I would, but that's my take upon it.
Sure, and certainly people can pick up a copy of the book to get both takes on it. I want to finally ask you about how, unfortunately, even those among the left side of the spectrum can also fall a little bit into that trap of fundamentalism, if you will. Sometimes the more fundamentalist we are about the positions we take, the more blind we can be to truth. And in our zeal to fight for the truth, we can sometimes ignore it as well, right?
Exactly, exactly. Well, fundamentalism, you know, is a mindset, I think. And you become a fundamentalist. In fact, I have known atheist fundamentalists. It may sound like a contradiction in terms, but I've known people for whom atheism was an absolute faith, and for whom and anyone who disagreed with them was cast into the outer darkness, just as religious fundamentalists regard so-called infidels. And so fundamentalism can be a characteristic of people on at any point in the ideological spectrum, as Eric Hoffer realized many years ago when he published his famous book, The True Believer. You can have a, you know, true believer of any ideological stripe.
Well, Keith, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you and your co-author with this book. Appreciate the time you've spent with us.
Well, thank you so very much, and I really have enjoyed this, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about these things that are so important.
Thank you. Likewise, my guest has been Keith M. Parsons, a professor of philosophy at the University of Houston, Clear Lake. His earlier books include It Started with Copernicus, Rational Episodes, and God and the Burden of Proof. We've been discussing the new book he's just co-authored with Paris M. Donahue called Polarized, The Collapse of Truth, Civility, and Community in Divided Times, and How We Can Find Common Ground. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.